If you could get into the ring with any of the WWE women, who would you choose?
I would probably choose Alexa Bliss or maybe the Bella Twin. So I think those ladies are great, and I'd love to wrestle. I mean, I would love to wrestle, like, my all-time favorites, like Cold Stone Steve Austin, Hulk Hogan. Like, that's who I grew up watching. I love wrestling. I'm a fan.
Ah, yes. The great Cold Stone Steve Austin. Funny part about that is I read this story on SE Scoops. I'm just not sure if that's one scoop or two.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client!
Mama Monster!
Conquered the street!
You like fighting a woman?
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Come over here and fight me!
Delete! You haven't been beat up properly! Woo!
I love that. Cold Stone Steve Austin. She's a fan, she says. She's a wrestling fan, a fan of the great Cold Stone Steve Austin. And yes, before people start tweeting me and emailing me, well, Solid Monster, Mike Tyson did the same thing. Yes, I'm aware. I'm just busting balls. I still thought it was funny. If you're such a huge fan, I don't know how you can confuse Stone Cold with Cold Stone, but anyway... this is episode 556 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off, here for Sunday, July 22nd, 2018. I am the Solid Monster. That is, for those of you who don't know, that was Farrah Abraham. I mentioned her name last week. She is a former star of Teen Mom. I mentioned Teen Mom 2 when I was doing my rundown of all the top cable shows last week, which I will do again later. Raw rebounded slightly in the ratings this past week, so I have a lot to talk about when it comes to that. Before we get into any of that, though, some of you wanted me to comment on this. I will very briefly here. I mentioned on Twitter, I saw a movie this week that up until maybe, I don't know, 4 or 5 days ago, I didn't even know existed. Apparently, it came out in June, and there was this great review that I came across from the New York Times and about this documentary about Mr. Rogers. I mean, anybody who remembers, you know, Mr. Rogers from when you were a kid, I mean, he was a big part of a lot of people's childhoods. Him and Sesame Street. Now Sesame Street, I think, is on HBO. You got to pay for it. And it's funny because, you know, I hadn't been to the movies probably before last week when I saw The Rock's movie, Skyscraper, which did not do that well here in this country, although I laugh when people say, oh, the movie was a flop. Okay, come back to me in 6 weeks or 3 months or whatever when the returns come in from China, because that movie's probably going to do, like, ridiculous numbers in China and make back all the money that they put into it. That's usually the way these things work these days. So I'm sure, in the end, I'm sure the movie will do just fine. But it did underperform here in this country, and again, it was okay. I mean, it's whatever. It wasn't anything special. But before that, I don't think I'd been to the movies in probably a year, year and a half. There just wasn't anything really appealing that came out that I was interested in. Plus, I don't know, I'm like really souring on the movie theater experience because people are just assholes, you know, who don't know how to behave in a movie theater. So I try to go as little as possible, but I went to go see Skyscraper, and then a week later, I'm back at the movie seeing a Mr. Rogers documentary. That's quite the... That's quite the dichotomy there between those two types of films. But I saw it, and it does live up to everything that people have been saying about it. It is a tremendous documentary. I did learn some things in there I did not know before. It is kind of a fluff piece about Mr. Rogers' family. His you know, widow and his children are very heavily involved. So it's kind of like seeing things through the prism of a WWE documentary, or like the Andre the Giant documentary, right? They had the cooperation of WWE when they made it. I don't know, frankly, that you're going to be able to find stuff about Mr. Rogers that's overly controversial anyway. But yes, it is done with their cooperation, so it is a very glowing piece about him and his life and the kind of person he was, but you would be hard-pressed, like I said, to find anything I would think salacious that I've ever heard about Mr. Rogers. You know, it's kind of sad because, I don't know, I just feel like in today's day and age, and some of the sick stories that come out about people that you at least expect, like I think of the Jimmy Savile thing in the UK. I don't want to get into that whole thing, but anybody who lives in the UK, you're well aware of the whole Jimmy Savile thing. And just stories about these people who were, you know... associated with kids, and then you find out years later all these horrible things they did. And, you know, thankfully we haven't heard that about Mr. Rogers, but I kind of think to myself, man, it's almost like you're waiting for the shoe to drop one day. It's kind of sad that I think we live in times like that where your mind kind of goes to that, like, oh, everybody kind of deifies him, but what was the real Mr. Rogers like? And to my knowledge, you know, there's never been, you know, anything the slightest bit really controversial about the guy. You watch this documentary and you come away from it thinking this guy was too good for this world. You know, he was just an amazing individual, and I would absolutely recommend it. And I will warn you, even the hardest of hardcore among you probably will find it difficult to get through the movie without this weird liquid coming from your eyeballs. I made it almost all the way through, and then we got to the end of the movie, and they got me. But anyway, yeah, it's called Won't You Be My Neighbor. It's in limited release. It came out last month. I don't know how much longer it'll be in theaters for. I'm sure it's going to pop up on Netflix or something within a few months. But yeah, of all the things to recommend, I'm actually recommending you all go see a Mr. Rogers documentary. Thank you to everybody who's been taking advantage of our Audible link. Audibletrial.com/Solomonster is the link exclusively for you guys. If you punch in that link, you can sign up for a free 30-day trial of the service. You get one free audiobook of your choice. And you have no excuses as far as all the options that you have, all the different wrestling books that are on there. So take advantage, audibletrial.com/Solomonster. Every time you do, you're supporting the podcast. So even if you've already used it, maybe you have a friend or a family member who's a reader, or I guess in this case, a listener. Everybody listens, right? So spread that link around. Thank you also to everybody who made a PayPal donation. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout out here on this show. Roll call with all of our great supporters here. John Luz Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, the Florida Freebird Brian Becerra, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Luis Hercules Hernandez, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Raymond the Mountie Medina, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Malaysian Mastermind Samuel T, Aim for the Head Andrew Jorlog, we have the Show Off Corey Van Dam, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichert. I feel like I could recite these names without even looking at the screen. We have Matt Slap My Patoot Silly Scala. I think Matt needs to come up with a different name, but that's just my suggestion. That was his nickname, but my suggestion is we can probably come up with a cooler name, I think, for Matt. But Matt wants me to remind everybody of a random funny line from the Hulk Hogan days of TNA, when he once said, in reference to the smaller wrestlers on the roster, "Those guys barely go up to my nipples, brother." I had forgotten about that, and he was reminded of it recently, I guess, and wanted me to mention it, so there you go. Stephen Foulmouth Fowler, Short Fuse Sean Simpson, the Renton Road Warrior Taylor Schatt, the Anarchist Andrew Heller, world-famous Dan Leopold, the Ambassador of Disaster Chase Wood, and the Leicester Defender Sukhdeep Pooney over in the UK. Thank you, everybody who made a donation. You could do so on the Solomonster.com. That is the place to go. Right-hand side of the page, you will see the PayPal button. I am working, it's going to take a while, but I am working towards actually turning the Solomonster.com into a real website. I've not been happy with it being more of a landing page for so long, and so I'm going to be putting some work into that, and hopefully within a few months we'll have that looking nice and refreshed, and maybe we'll have some other content on there. It's going to be good. So that's something to watch for. I have a whole bunch of ideas. You guys don't even know. I have a whole bunch of ideas. Actually, there's a couple of cool things I'll also be announcing in the next couple of weeks. But anyway, let's talk about Extreme Rules here. Extreme Rules was last Sunday. My full Sound Off Extra review is up on the YouTube channel. You can find it there. All 85,000 plus of you that have viewed it, thank you very much. The final Twitter poll results, there were 3,700 votes. 20% voted thumbs up. 45% voted thumbs down. And 35% voted thumbs in the middle. I did a thumbs in the middle option this time, even though I'm not a huge fan of that. But still, 20% thumbs up, not very good. Much like this show, not very good. I said this in the review. That was a full card. You had 11 matches on that card, or 12. No, I think it was 11. 11 matches on that card. When you have a card where out of 11 matches, only 2 or 3 are really considered good, not a good show does that make. This pay-per-view, I would liken it to being like a baseball player who goes 1-for-4 in a game, and that one is like a base hit only because the first baseman bobbled the ball. That was Extreme Rules. There was one commenter on the YouTube video who made an interesting observation, storyline-wise, about one of the things on the show, and he proposed this. He said, what if they have Braun Strowman terrorizing Kevin Owens like this, as he was doing for weeks and weeks and weeks, just to have Owens screw Braun over when he goes to cash in his Money in the Bank contract? That actually would be a great idea. I mean, I would like to see Braun actually successfully cash in, and I guess in this case he wouldn't, but the idea of it, I actually like the idea. To me, though, if you're going to do that, you've just got to keep Owens off television completely until the cash-in. And so if it happens at SummerSlam, that's how long you've got to keep Kevin Owens off television for to make that, I think, more effective. Let people forget about him, because if Owens is gone for 4 or 5 weeks, you know, out of sight, out of mind, I don't think very many people would be expecting him to show up, let's say, if Strowman went to cash in at the end of SummerSlam, and all of a sudden here comes Kevin Owens in street clothes, which I guess he always wears street clothes, but here comes Kevin Owens, and he screws over Braun, gets his revenge for all the shit that Strowman put him through, and nobody sees it coming. Not a bad idea. Not a bad idea. I don't know where you go from there, though. That's the issue, because what do you... I mean, you're just going to continue the Strowman-Owens feud? I mean, I think it's kind of played out by now. And where does Braun go from there? Because if he doesn't succeed in cashing in, I think that hurts him more than it helps Kevin Owens. So it's the follow-up that I'm not entirely sure about, but the idea of it, I think, is kind of cool and something that nobody would see coming. And maybe it ends up with Kevin Owens doing something meaningful out of it. Kane's injury. I was talking during my review about him having the walking boot on. Turns out that that injury is legit. The broken ankle is a cover for what is apparently an Achilles tendon injury that he suffered on the go-home show before Extreme Rules. So the boot he was wearing was for a real injury. An Achilles injury, no less. At 50 years old. And he was in the ring hitting choke slams. He's lucky it's not a rupture. That's a very difficult injury to come back from, even for a younger person. Hopefully it's not a rupture. It doesn't sound like it's quite that serious, but an Achilles rupture would be devastating to, I think, someone like him. Now, of course, he's about to become mayor, and I suspect we're not going to be seeing Kane for a very long time. So as I, you know, even if he wasn't hurt, as I suspected, the whole Team Hell No thing was just a really temporary thing. I didn't see it going on for very long. I didn't see them winning the titles or anything like that. You know, it was a nice little pop when they first reunited. I'm sure a lot of people enjoyed it. I was sort of ready for it to be done and over with. You know, I'm not interested in the Daniel Bryan Greatest Hits show. I mean, if the guy is back, I want him to start getting in the mix, even though I understand his contract status is still unresolved. And so you got to factor that into things. But Kane came back, he had a nice little return, and now he can go do mayor things in the meantime and heal up. I want to talk about Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan was another story on Extreme Rules Sunday. Hogan was in Pittsburgh last Sunday to meet with the entire roster backstage, because for these pay-per-views now, they're co-branded shows, which means all the talent from Raw and SmackDown are there. And so they gathered the troops, and they brought Hogan in to talk to everybody and to give a speech backstage. They initially made the announcement that he was being reinstated into the WWE Hall of Fame. So this is not for a full-blown return. As far as I've read or heard or anything like that, there's no contract that's been signed, at least not yet. I'm sure it's inevitable. And maybe not, though. You know, depending, I'm sure this was done in part to sort of test the waters and see what the reaction would be. And the reaction has not been, you know, 100% great. So maybe they have second thoughts about doing stuff with Hogan going forward after this. But they gathered everybody up, and he was said to be very apologetic. But he also talked about how careful all of the talent need to be in today's day and age of cell phone cameras and social media, and be careful of people recording you without your knowledge or without your consent. And, you know, when I read that, I thought the same thing that apparently, if these reports are accurate, a lot of the African-American talent felt, and I know a lot of you feel as well, based on your reactions on my timeline, which is, this is not the time nor the place to be making that argument, because all that is, or all it comes off as, is Hogan making excuses. The absolute last thing that Hulk Hogan should be doing right now is even the perception that he is making any sort of excuse for what he did all those years ago. Because there is no excuse for it. If the man really is sincere in his apology, that is the worst thing that he could have done, was to talk about that, because what he's doing there is he's playing the victim card. And look, he was a victim. We've been through this before. He was a victim. His privacy was violated, and that part was awful. But these guys don't give a shit about Hulk Hogan's privacy being violated. They didn't gather everybody together for some, sappy speech because they felt sorry for Hulk Hogan because somebody recorded him without his knowledge. That was not what that meeting, I don't think, was supposed to be or should not have been about. Apparently, they thought it would be a good idea. None of those guys wanted to hear about Hulk Hogan being the victim. It makes it sound like he's sorry less about having said all of those horrible things and more about having been caught and how unfair it is that he got caught. I don't know who thought that would be a good idea. If that was all Hogan, if that was a Triple H call who apparently introduced Hogan in the meeting and said something along the same lines, if that was a Vince McMahon idea, I don't know. There is a time and a place for that. That was neither the time nor the place for a privacy lesson. The lesson should not be, it's okay to say racist shit so long as it's not recorded. Make sure you do that behind closed doors. People are out to get you. That should not be the message. The lesson should be, I'm sorry, I fucked up, that's not who I am, and I'm going to do everything in my power to prove to you that that's not who I really am. I can't do that with words. I can only do that with actions. That's it. This is 101 of communications here. My mind is just boggled that they thought that that would be a good idea and that would go over well. Now, as far as reinstatement into the Hall of Fame, he never should have been removed in the first place. And really, we talk about removing him from the Hall of Fame. He wasn't removed from the Hall of Fame. There is no Hall of Fame. There is no plaque in a building somewhere that they took down. There's no statue like Joe Pa in Happy Valley that they knocked down. It was a website. He had his name taken off a webpage. Hulk Hogan was never out of the WWE Hall of Fame. But, even if they had taken him out of the Hall of Fame, I didn't support that. You can't unring that bell. He's in the Hall of Fame, he's in the Hall of Fame. Everything else, though, is fair game. When it comes to working with him, when it comes to putting him on TV, when it comes to him being a spokesperson, putting him in video games, putting out action figures, and him making money off all this stuff, all that is fair game. And I completely understand why WWE felt the need to distance themselves from someone like that. Because they're toxic. It doesn't matter if he made the comments 8 years ago or 8 hours ago. If you run a company with somebody like Hulk Hogan, who is effectively just a spokesperson, he's not an active performer anymore in the ring, how can you expect for this guy to be the public face or one of the public faces of your company? Mark Henry was at that meeting. He told TMZ the reaction to Hogan's mea culpa amongst the black wrestlers was pretty much split right down the middle, 50-50, with some of the... Although that's not what I've heard. I've heard it's a little bit more than that. But he claims it was split 50-50 with some of the guys basically saying, to hell with Hogan, to hell with this guy. I don't care about him. I don't want to hear from him. I don't want to associate with him. Kofi Kingston posted a lengthy statement on behalf of the New Day. Since they were being bombarded with messages about what they thought about Hogan coming back. Let me just read this to you here. I'm sure most of you have heard this by now, but some of you maybe haven't. He said, "We preface this statement by embracing, or emphasizing rather, that this is our own opinion and may not necessarily reflect the opinion of anybody else affected. How do we feel? Indifferent. We are not happy. We are not sad, angry, or resentful. Who WWE puts in the Hall of Fame is totally and completely up to the company, and from a career standpoint, there is no argument on whether or not Hogan should have his place. We have no problem with his reintroduction in the slightest degree. It is impossible to even begin to mention the history and evolution of the business without mentioning his name and his accolades. On a personal level, when someone makes racist and hateful comments about any race or group of people, especially to the degree that Hogan made about our people, we find it difficult to simply forget, regardless of how long ago it was, or the situation. in which those comments were made, but we also do not respond with more feelings of hate. Instead, we just do not associate with the people who convey or have conveyed this negative and hurtful mindset. This instance will be no different. Perhaps if we see him make a genuine effort to change, maybe our opinion will change with him. Time will tell. Through the course of our lives, people have used racist comments towards us, and it does not feel good. But if we stop moving forward every time we were met with prejudice hatred, we would have never achieved our current accomplishments. We know we are worth it, we know our kids are worth it, and most importantly, we know that people that look like us are worth it and always have been. There is not one person on this planet who will ever be able to say anything to make us think otherwise, because we believe in ourselves as a people and don't need anyone's approval on that, regardless of who they are. Having said that, his reinstatement will not change anything for us. It will have zero effect on our ability to perform or the level of effort that we will put into doing what we love to do. I thought that statement was all class. Very well said. The complete and polar opposite of what I just talked about in terms of what Hogan did in this meeting. This was a perfect statement. They were being honest about how they felt. They were acknowledging that, hey, you can't take away the man's accomplishments. He should be in the Hall of Fame. No problem, but we choose not to associate with people like that. We also don't choose to reciprocate by putting more hate out there. We want to do the opposite. So I thought that was a very classy, very respectful, very well put together statement from Kofi Kingston. Titus O'Neil had a similar response after some false reports emerged saying that he walked out of the pay-per-view when he saw Hogan or was told Hogan was there. I was very skeptical of that. This was his statement. This was Titus's statement. The reports and rumors concerning my boycotting Extreme Rules in Pittsburgh are false and inaccurate. I was not scheduled to attend or participate in the Extreme Rules match production and otherwise was not booked for the show. The talent present in Pittsburgh, which I was a part of, was asked to attend a mandatory meeting in which Mr. Terry Bollea addressed everybody and informed the same that he would be reinstated into the WWE Hall of Fame. At no point during, after, or otherwise did I make any scene regarding Mr. Bollea's communication to the talent. In addition, let it be known that I did not refuse to shake Mr. Bollea's hand. We did not have any type of one-on-one interaction whatsoever that would or did necessitate any exchange between us individually. As to the reinstatement of Mr. Bollea, I can only communicate that I am a proponent of second and even third chances for individuals that show true remorse, acknowledgement of wrongdoing, fulfill their punishment, if applicable, and otherwise put forth sincere efforts to correct the issues. Unfortunately, I must echo the sentiment and dissatisfaction expressed by many of my fellow contemporaries concerning Mr. Bollea's apology and its lack of true contrition, remorse, and a desire to change. His apology that he did not know he was being recorded, quote-unquote, is not remorse for the hateful and violent utterances he made, which reprised language that have caused violence against blacks and minorities for centuries. I stand firm in my position that Mr. Bollea is entitled to reinstatement. He was and is a role model, hero, and an icon to countless people. I hope that his missteps in communicating to the WWE talent in Pittsburgh are not repeated to his fans, and I expect that he shall pursue an agenda that clearly communicates to all third parties that his language was inappropriate, wrong, and should not be tolerated in a civilized and inclusive society. And then he goes on to talk about being a father to two young kids, and I have a lot of respect for Titus, but it went up with that statement. It went up even more. Titus O'Neil is an example. Say what you want to about, you know, his matches and all that sort of thing, but Titus O'Neil is somebody who is again, sort of the polar opposite of Hogan at this point here in 2018, in that he's someone that company should want to have front and center as a representative of their brand in a public setting. Hulk Hogan is not, or certainly was not, you know, you can argue, you know, should he be back now or not, but of the two, if I had to put a brand ambassador out there to speak on behalf of my company and talk up my company and show people, you know, what the WWE talent are all about, I'd put Titus out there ahead of Hogan. You know, Titus did a TED Talk last year that was completely separate from WWE. You know, he's a very articulate guy. He's very smart. And I just read this and thought to myself, this is exactly the kind of statement I would expect from somebody like Titus O'Neil. And for the people who worry that WWE might punish these guys, uh-oh, they spoke out of turn. You better watch out. They're going to bury them, or they're going to fire them, or they're going to do something. I don't think there's anything to worry about. WWE cannot possibly, for all the dumb things this company does, they cannot possibly be that stupid and tone deaf as to do anything in retaliation against those guys for speaking out on an issue like this. Especially with statements like that, that were very respectful, very non-combative. You know, if they came out and said, fuck Hulk Hogan, I hope he gets mowed down by a bus carrying the Harlem Globetrotters, that would be different. That might get them into some hot water. They said nothing wrong. And if they were stupid enough, this company, to punish them over it, I hope they all band together and sue the shit out of this company. As mindful as they are of their image, WWE is, trust me, they're not going to do a damn thing. But that's not to say the company doesn't have their moments where they're stupid and tone deaf. Case in point, the Hogan meeting last week. That was a big mistake. And apparently Hogan's got a lot more work to do if he wants to win over the talent in the locker. Apparently that's very important to him. He wants to get back in their good graces. And for all the people that may have had issues backstage with Hogan, there were people that applauded him and that, you know, greeted him with open arms. I don't want to make it sound like everybody was against him. But, you know, there was a vocal contingent of talent, obviously, coming out of that meeting that was not happy with what Hogan said and how he said it. And to me, it's just a huge PR blunder that didn't have to happen. And it was not anything, I think, that's going to help his cause. Jerry Lawler was on his Dinner with the King podcast talking about Howard Finkel. We haven't heard too much about the Fink. We haven't seen him, obviously, on TV. He hasn't been at WrestleMania the last couple of years. Maybe his voice was at some point, but he was not. And he mentioned on his podcast that Howard is in really, really bad shape health-wise right now. He said, I just heard not long ago that Howard is in really, really bad health, not good at all. He may have had a stroke. I'm not sure, but I just know that he's not doing well. Kind of messed up to even say that if you don't know for sure that the man did have a stroke. I'm not sure why he would come out and say that. I don't know why he wouldn't just come out and say what he said at the beginning. The guy is in poor health and just leave it there. Because he even admits he's not sure. But that's awful news. That's just terrible. Finkel is not someone who was typically like overly active on Twitter. He has a Twitter account. He would comment on there. He would tweet about WWE, but he would also tweet about the Mets. He's a huge Mets fan. Maybe the reason he hasn't commented, because he has not tweeted anything since Bruno Sammartino passed away in April. And here we are in July. And Howard has been radio silent on social media since then, which is very concerning. But then I see, you know, he's a huge Mets fan, so perhaps he's just as depressed as the rest of us are about this team and just has nothing to say. But best wishes to the Fink. To me, there's never been a better ring announcer, probably in all of wrestling, but certainly in WWE. There's never been anybody better than him who has that sort of big match, big fight feel to, you know, to his match announcements. And he's the guy I grew up on, so obviously I have a certain, you know, there's a certain nostalgia, I guess, involved there as well. But I think even somebody who didn't grow up on the guy, if you were to listen to Howard Finkel announce, you know, big-time main events for a year and put him next to anyone else, I would find it impossible for them to come away from it not thinking that, hey, this guy's pretty good at this ring announcing thing. He was the best. And his run ended way earlier than it should have because I guess he no longer looked the part in their eyes, too old, whatever. His health has not been great for a while now. And really, and I've mentioned this on the podcast before, one of the saddest things that I've seen was him not being able to leave the ring on his own power at WrestleMania 32. After he did the Hall of Fame announcements in the ring, the place went dark. They probably, you know, went to the next video package or whatever. And I was watching the ring. And I don't know if it was just because he was that big, because his weight did very much get out of control, or if there was some other issue involved, but he needed to be helped out of the ring. It took several minutes to get him out of the ring. They had to help him out underneath the bottom rope just to sort of, you know, roll him out of there. And it's just, I remember watching that, and I commented on it that night when we did the review, and I said, man, that's just, that was one of the saddest moments that I've ever seen at a WWE show. And that was a couple of years ago at this point. So best wishes to the Fink. I hope whatever it is that he's dealing with, he pulls out of it, and we get to see him back on TV in some capacity at some point and hear his voice again. G1 Climax. Want to spend some time talking about the G1 here, because I got to see, I thought I was only going to get to see a couple of matches this week, and there have been a lot of great matches in this year's G1 so far. I wish I had time to get to all of them, but I did end up catching six of them this week. And five of the six matches I thought were excellent. Two of them from night four, and the other four from night six. So I just want to run through some quick thoughts on each of these six matches here. Zack Sabre Jr. against Toriano was the first match I saw this week. Now, Sabre won the New Japan Cup earlier this year. He beat a whole bunch of big names along the way. Naito, Ibushi, Tanahashi. This should have been a night off for this guy in there against somebody like Yano. Yano largely is a comedy guy, but one of the great stories of this year's G1 is that Yano is actually wrestling for a change. He had, you know, like seriously wrestling. And this match was awesome. Yano said going into the G1, he's not going to break the rules anymore. He's going to play it straight, not going to break the rules. So right away, we get chain wrestling in this match, a bunch of reversals. They go into the crowd. Sabre puts him in a submission. And he runs back into the ring at the count of 15. Because there's a 20 count in Japan, refs up to 15. Sabre lets go. He bolts into the ring. He's going to try to get a count out win here because, you know, you get 2 points. Actually, I don't know if it's 2 points for a count-out win or if it's just 2 points for any win. I think it might be 2 points for a pin or submission, maybe a point for a count-out or a DQ. I'm not. Don't quote me on that. But he wants the points. That's really what the G1 is all about. And it looks like Yano is going to be counted out, but he races back in to beat the 20 count. Yano then reverses an abdominal stretch attempt by Sabre into one of his own. People were going nuts for this. They were going nuts for basic reversals and basic maneuvers because it's not the sort of thing you're used to seeing out of this guy. They end up back outside again. Sabre ties up Yano long enough to try to get him counted out. This time, he literally tied the man's legs up in the guardrail and put him in a double wrist lock and just waited and waited and waited until the count of 18. He waited until 18. And Sabre rushes back inside. Now I'm watching this thinking he waited too long. No way Yano's getting back in time. Yano has to unwrap his legs first from the guardrail and barely, and I do mean barely, makes it back inside just in the nick of time. In reality, the referee clearly held up the count for about a second because there was no way that Yano was getting back in time. But just barely made it back in. They cut that one a little too close there. But it's smart, right? I mean, it's like holding onto the bottom rope in a Royal Rumble match, the Road Dogg strategy. Logically, I'm not sure why more people don't stall outside and try to get their opponent counted out. I mean, come on, man. That would be my strategy. It's all about racking up points in this tournament. Yano undid the corner pad and tried to use it as a weapon. The referee ripped it out of his hands. There were a series of near falls back and forth. Sabre ends up running into the exposed corner. Yano runs into the opposite corner and undoes that pad as well. Tries to use that as a weapon. Sabre ducks it. And he wins with what Rocky Romero called the ghetto clutch with a bridge, pins Yano and gets the win. This was not a match I would have expected to be on my list of G1 matches to go out of my way to see, but this was a lot of fun. Just, you know, very simple match in a lot of ways, simple story, but it makes all of Yano's matches more interesting going forward to see if he keeps up with the more serious style. So then after that, I watched Kota Ibushi against Juice Robinson. This was more in line with what I was expecting. It did not disappoint. Ibushi hit a jumping Rana from the ring apron on Juice. Words can't even do justice to some of the things that Ibushi did in this match. And that was one of them. So just picture these two out on the apron. Here comes, they're on the apron. Here comes Juice running towards him and just Ibushi just standing there, jumps up, hits a Rana. It's amazing they didn't kill each other on that move. As if that isn't crazy enough, what does he do? He immediately follows that up with a moonsault off the ring post. Because the turnbuckle's not enough. He's got to do it off the ring post. out to the floor. Ibushi is out of his mind. You don't need me to say that, but he is out of his mind. Back and forth, Juice tries to hit Pulp Friction. Ibushi escapes. Straightjacket German. Knee to the face for the win. Ibushi gets 2 points. He beats the United States champion. Perhaps setting up for the eventual title match. You know, maybe Ibushi gets a U.S. title shot at some point. Although the match I want to see is Ibushi against Kenny Omega. I'd rather see him challenge for a different championship. But this was great stuff. This was great stuff. I missed all the matches from Night 5. But I did see 4 matches from Night 6. Yano and Ibushi. I love this. I love this. And knowing the backgrounds of these guys, you would expect the match just a total comedy match. It was in many ways a comedy match. Not completely. There was some actual wrestling in this match, but there was a lot of comedy. But it was so absurd that it just worked. Now, 3 years ago, Yano pinned Ibushi in less than a minute in the G1 after a pair of low blows. So right away, they're playing off it like, we might get another quick finish. There's some near falls, but there's no pins. Yano goes around, outside, he's yanking off, he's untying and yanking off all but one of those corner pads that they have in the New Japan rings. Ibushi ends up taking the other one off himself. So now all 4 corners are exposed. Ibushi hit a twisting moonsault from the top rope out to the floor that almost killed Yano. I cringe when I see people do that because I can't watch that anymore, like moonsaults onto people's heads on the outside and stuff like that, because it just makes me think of the Jesse Sorensen injury in TNA when DJZ landed right on his head on a moonsault and he hit it in he hit him in just the right spot and paralyzed him. Now, thankfully, he recovered to live a normal life and wrestle again, but it was very, very scary. I remember that injury. It's kind of one of those things you don't forget. You know, I was watching TNA at the time. I think it was the opening match of that pay-per-view, whichever show it was. And, so I kind of cringe whenever I see people doing moonsaults like that onto the floor and landing on people's heads. I worry about that. But anyway, they did some fun spots inside where they teased throwing each other or attempting to, being that all the corners were exposed, threatening to throw each other into the corner and they would stop short and the crowd would sort of react to it. Yano grabbed some athletic tape from underneath the ring. He was going to tie up Ibushi with it. The referee took it away. Little did he know that Yano had more tape tucked away in his tights, and he used it to tie up Ibushi's hands. So the guy is hogtied. And with no hands, Kota Ibushi hit a picture-perfect standing dropkick, and then later he hit a picture-perfect standing moonsault with no hands. Red Shoes got bumped. That allowed Yano, who said he would not break the rules in this tournament, it allowed Yano to hit a low blow and a chop block and then roll up Kota Ibushi for the shock win. That is Yano's first win of the G1, and it came against Kota Ibushi. Who knew that watching Yano matches would be the most fun I've had watching wrestling all week? And there was some good stuff on TV this week. Yeah, SmackDown, Lucha Underground. But this is the most fun I've had watching anything all week, is the Yano stuff. We had Naito against Juice Robinson. Another fantastic match. Juice has a broken left hand, which is a legitimate injury, hence the cast that he has on his hand. And Naito went after it for a good part of the match. He even hit a sliding drop kick to the hand. You know, Juice was in a seated position. And Naito hit the ropes for what normally would be a drop kick to the face, but instead he gave him a drop kick to the hand, which was kind of unique. Naito went for the Destino a few times. Each time Juice would counter it, he tried for Pulp Friction. He couldn't hit it. Naito hit a German, went for the Destino again. This time Juice countered with a lariat. Again, Pulp Friction attempt. But again, Naito blocks it and finally hits the Destino, gets a near fall, hits it a second time, and gets the pin. So this match put Juice at 0-2 so far in the G1. And you could tell from his promo after the match, he is not taking it very well.
I fucking hate G1s. How about that? I fucking hate G1s.
What's that?
Because I'm hurt every damn time we do this goddamn tour. Sorry, I know you're a good Christian boy.
You can say which one.
I'm agnostic. Don't don't know what happens when you die, but I do know one thing. I know what's going to happen to me in the G1. God, I'm going to be defending this fucking title against 9 other guys. 0-2. 0-2. No secret, Kota Ibushi's better than me, huh? No secret. We all know that. Now Naito. Everybody in Japan loves Naito, right? Why not? He's cool. He's cool. I don't want to sit here and be lame and say, but he doesn't follow the rules. That's not who I am. Naito's fucking smart, man. What do you used to be called? Stardust Genius? Some bullshit like that?
There's definitely genius in it.
Something genius is in it. Yeah, he's a fucking shark that smells blood. That's what he is. Okay? Yeah. I went to the doctor yesterday, and the doctor said that my hand's 70%. 70%. You know what he said after that? He said, just make sure you don't punch anything. Make sure you don't karate chop anything. Make sure nobody steps on it, stomps on it, hits it with a chair, slams it in a guardrail, puts it in a submission. He said all those things too. And then I looked at him like he was a dumbass. Because guess what? This is fucking New Japan. I can't just go out there with a bad hand and expect everybody's just going to be like, oh, well, Juice's hand's hurt. We're just going to be good sportsmen. No way. Naito's an asshole. He's a bastard. He's a son of a bitch. And this tour is long. He wants to beat me as fast as he can, trust me, because he has to do it 6 more fucking times. Okay? 6 more times. This is the 20 best wrestlers in the world. Actually, it's fucking 19 of the best wrestlers in the world and me. This title is supposed to make me feel really good, huh? But as soon as I get it, I just turn into the biggest loser. The biggest loser.
Kenny Omega against Tama Tonga. The firing squad attacked Omega before the bell. Hangman Page and Chase Owens made the save. This was the one match I really did not like. Of the 6 I watched, this was the one that I guess would be at the bottom of my list. This is the one that disappointed me. Tama Tonga did try to kill Omega with a Styles Clash onto a chair, which was cool after seeing AJ endorse the firing squad at Comic-Con this week. A fan asked AJ, Team Kenny or the firing squad? And AJ pointed out that after his last match in New Japan, Omega and those guys beat the crap out of him, so he is Team Firing Squad. But Red Shoes pushed the chair away, Tama Tonga shoved him, he shoved Tama Tonga back, and he ate a gun stun for the DQ. And the Tongans all attacked Omega after the match and wrapped a chair around his neck before Ibushi, Page, and Owens ran out for the save. This pushed the whole Elite versus Firing Squad stuff, but as a match, really wasn't anything special. And the last match I saw was the Hirooki Goto against Tomohiro Ishii main event from Night 6. There's not much to say here. These two guys just beat the absolute piss out of each other. They traded stiff kicks, stiff chops, stiff lariats. They probably went out after the show and had a stiff drink. There is nothing soft about the style that these guys use inside that ring. Ishii won with a brainbuster. Brutal match. I mean, if you're a fan of strong style, hard-hitting stuff, this is the match that you want to see, probably from the entire tournament so far. I enjoyed it. I thought it was really good. But man, these guys just beat the ever-loving hell out of each other. So I'm trying to fit in as much of the G1 as I can, but everything I've seen so far has been A+, and there are some really interesting matches yet to come. So I am enjoying the hell out of this year's G1 so far. One thing I'm not enjoying the hell out of lately, Monday Night Raw. Raw was in Buffalo, New York last week. Twitter poll, 2,600 votes. 28% thumbs up, 72% thumbs down. Yeesh. On Friday, WWE announced breaking news. Stephanie McMahon returns to Raw this Monday night for a historic announcement. She is going to announce that it was her and not Susan B. Anthony who presented the amendment to Congress that gave women the right to vote. Or that the only reason Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on that bus was because she told her to. That's what my sources are telling me. It could be either or. I'm getting conflicting stories here. What a trailblazer. What a trailblazer. Clyde would be proud. Look, the belief is that the announcement is going to be the long-rumored all-women's pay-per-view, which is very likely taking place in the fall. I was speculating last week that it could maybe take the place of what was the spot that TLC had on the schedule in Boston at the end of October. But PW Insider is hearing that it could be September, and it could be taking place at the Nassau Coliseum in Long Island, New York. That sounds like a great idea. Why not just run Corpus Christi? Why don't you just do that? I've been to the Nassau Coliseum, okay? Ever since I was a little kid, I have been to the Nassau Coliseum. I've been to the Nassau Coliseum in recent years, many, many times. It is not the best market for a live crowd. I don't know why. I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's Long Island. But who knows? Maybe as this historic first time ever women's show, if that is what the announcement is, maybe the people there will be really into it and they'll be really excited and they'll be really loud and they'll prove me wrong. But if I were doing a show like this, Nassau would not be in the top five on my list of places that I would want to run. This week, the cable top 10 looked like this. Number 10, The Real Housewives of the OC. Oh boy. More reality rejects, just what we need. Teen Mom 2, Street Outlaws, Basketball Wives, Love and Hip Hop Atlanta. The 8 p.m. hour of Raw actually took the number 2 spot this past week, and number 1 was the Home Run Derby. And so, speaking of Love and Hip Hop, I was alerted this week by somebody. I wish I would have made a note of your name, but he tweeted me and said, you might want to take a look at this. Apparently, there was a wrestling episode or a wrestling storyline on one of the earlier episodes this season of Love and Hip Hop, which I went back and watched. There was actually a tag team match with Stevie J teaming with some guy named Scrappy or Little Scrappy. I don't know. But they were being trained at some wrestling school down in Atlanta. And the owner runs a promotion there. And he said, look, if you guys let us train you, we'll put you in a tag team title match against our champions. Which I think actually turned out to be the promoter and somebody else, because they looked like the same people when they showed the match later on. But anyway, yet another argument for a ranking system here in wrestling. These two putzes walk in the door and they're already getting a title shot. Funny enough, AR Fox, Dante Fox from Lucha Underground, was one of the wrestlers training them. So I watched the match, and they call their finisher the Flying Saucer, which is the old Enzo and Cass rocket launcher move. And they won! They won the match with the Flying Saucer. But they did not win the titles, thank God. I guess it turned out not to be a title match. I didn't see any belts, so I guess the promoter came to his senses. Anyway, this week was part 2 of the reunion episode. I reviewed part 1, and so I thought I would end my Love and Hip Hop reviews with a quick look at part 2. Another near brawl on stage. The perfect way to open this episode. And this brawl was, or near brawl, was instigated by this girl named Tommy, who is a real piece of work. She seems to have a real attitude problem, this girl does. She shows up late to music rehearsals and physically attacks producers. Plus, she has to wear an alcohol monitor around her ankle. That's hardcore. You know you have a serious drinking problem when you need to wear an ankle bracelet. And the court doesn't even cover the costs of it. So that's $500 a month, I think, that she has to pay out of her own pocket. The other observation I had on this show, the editing on this show is horrendous. It's just completely abominable. The cuts to the audience applauding, it's like something out of one of those old Ron Popeil infomercials. Remember those? Remember Ronco, the Ronco Rotisserie Barbecue, right? Set it and forget it. That's what I do with Raw on my DVR these days. So we cut to a scene at someone's house, and Tommy shows up, and they show a little pig on the floor drinking out of a water bowl. They have a pet pig. This girl has a pig as a pet. The pig's name is Gucci, and Tommy is very upset because she claims the pig ejaculated all over her couch. Now, that's no way to talk about Stevie J now, come on. The pig ejaculated on her couch. So she evicted the pig and put the pig outside. Ejaculating pigs is not something I expected to be talking about on this week's show. But it's still more interesting than most things I've seen on Raw. Actually, I think this review just peaked with ejaculating pigs. There's really nothing else I can say that will top the absurdity of that, or the mental image that I now have in my head. So we'll end this prematurely. The host did sign off, though, at the end of the show. I did skim the rest of the show. At the very end, the host mentioned that Love and Hip Hop Hollywood premieres tomorrow night on VH1. That means there's going to be a whole new season, I assume, with a whole new cast of characters. There's plenty of ejaculating pigs in Hollywood. That whole city is infested with them. But I don't know if I'm going to check out Love and Hip Hop Hollywood. I think Atlanta is enough for me for now, but we'll see. You never know. If Raw's that bad and I start flipping channels... See, the thing about Raw, though, is I barely watch Raw live these days. Like, I could never... I was never one of these people that could just watch it later on. I had to watch it live, right? It just felt like if something happens, I want to be one of the first people that sees in real time what happens here. And I haven't felt that way probably in over a year. I rarely end up watching Raw live these days. Maybe this week I will. Maybe I will this week. We'll see. And if I get bored, I may flip around and you never know what I may end up on. But I can tell you this, whatever it is, based on what I'm seeing in these cable rankings, I bet you it's going to suck. Because cable TV on Monday nights sucks. Guess who's wrestling at SummerSlam, folks? As if there was really ever any doubt, Brock Lesnar, that's who. Kurt Angle on this show this past Monday was about to strip Lesnar of the Universal title when Paul Heyman showed up. He claimed that Brock actually loved being in WWE. He loved being the Universal Champion. I would too. If I could be champion and only show up 6 times a year and get paid $5 million, I'd love it too. He claimed what Brock's goal is. He wants to win the UFC heavyweight title while at the same time being the WWE Universal Champion. As if, you know, that's supposed to get the fans to, I guess, root for him or cheer for him. Why would the fans even give a fuck? Who gives a shit if he's the Universal Champion and the UFC Champion? What does that mean for the fans? The fans don't give a shit. So, of course, they all booed. And you know, Vince McMahon's plan, or part of his plan, which was, I guess, to get the people to turn on Lesnar and boo him and resent him for not showing up and not caring about him. Part A of his plan has been a success. It's part B that I'm not sure is going to work out too well for him in the end, which is to get Roman Reigns cheered. This is more about getting Roman Reigns cheered than it is about getting Brock Lesnar booed. But I guess in his eyes, to get to part B, you've got to first achieve part A. Well, part A has been a success. Now we'll see come SummerSlam time if Vince McMahon is the genius that everybody used to say he is. I don't see it. But we'll find out. But Heyman reluctantly agreed to have Brock defend the championship at SummerSlam. The question was, against who? Bobby Lashley came out. Drew McIntyre came out, Seth Rollins came out, Elias, Finn Balor, and of course, Roman Reigns. And so Angle decided to make 2 triple threat matches, with the winners facing off one-on-one this upcoming Monday night to determine a number one contender. In one match, we had Lashley, Elias, and Seth Rollins. In the other match, we had Roman Reigns, Drew McIntyre, and Finn Balor. I thought that was the better of the 2 matches. That was actually a really good match, I thought, the Reigns one. Reigns got busted open by the eye late in the match by, I think it was a headbutt, from McIntyre, but he hit a spear on Balor to move on to the number one contenders match tomorrow night, as if there was ever any doubt. And this is exactly the way I said it was probably going to go down when I did my predictions, right? I mean, when I did the Extreme Rules, predictions last week, I said I was going with Lashley to win because of this very reason. He gets a win, but it doesn't guarantee him a shot at Brock Lesnar at SummerSlam, and it allows them to do a big match on TV with Roman Reigns getting his win back, and then going on to challenge Brock for the championship. And it looks like, unless they swerve me, it looks like that's exactly what we're in for tomorrow night. Now, could it end in some sort of draw, or DQ, or non-decision, where we end up with a triple threat match at SummerSlam with Lesnar, Lashley, and Roman Reigns? Yeah, it's possible. It is possible. And I actually think that that could probably be a better match. You know, I've seen Brock in some 3-way matches. I mean, I keep thinking of the one he had at the Royal Rumble in 2015 with Cena and Rollins. That was one of the best matches all year. Brock maybe is at his best when he's in a match like that because he doesn't have to be the focal point and he can get bumped and then take a breather and then come back into things, a house of fire. You know, it's a formula that I think tends to work. So maybe that's the way to go. I still think Roman is getting the one-on-one win. I still think in the end that it will be Reigns winning straight up and going on to face Brock Lesnar. And what a crock of crap that would be, given that Lashley beat him clean in the middle of the ring the night before. It just makes it feel like that match had no consequences whatsoever. It actually kind of validates what Kurt Angle, his little you know, kayfabe tweet that he put up a couple of weeks ago that people was savaging him. Not even savaging him. They were sort of endorsing what Angle was saying. And then Angle deleted the tweet when he was you know, talking to Dash Wilder of The Revival and saying, you know, talking about meaningless tag team matches on Raw, right? That's exactly how the Reigns and Lashley match feels now from Extreme Rules. That was your one of your feature matches at the pay-per-view. And you pull something like this and it just feels completely meaningless. Unless Lashley wins again. If Lashley wins again tomorrow night, that only serves to make Lashley that much stronger. I have a very difficult time seeing Lashley just straight up beating Roman Reigns twice in a row and getting that match with Brock Lesnar at SummerSlam. Very, very hard for me to see that happening. But we'll find out. I still say it's going to end up being Reigns and Brock one-on-one. Kurt Angle forced Bayley and Sasha Banks to team up again on this show and said that if you guys can't get along, I'm going to have to trade one of you to SmackDown. Well, shit. If I'm either one of those ladies, I'm basically packing my bags. I'm pulling the equivalent of, what is it, when people get the jury duty summons, right? The old thing is, oh, just act like a racist. They'll dismiss you right away. If you don't want to serve, just go and say, I can't. I hate these people. I hate that people. So basically, I would have employed a similar strategy here. I would have told Kurt, oh yeah? Okay. Well, hey, shove it. I would have forced him. I would have forced his hand. Go ahead. Send me to SmackDown. I dare you. Why would someone like Sasha Banks not want to go to SmackDown? They have Paige as their GM. They'd have a whole new roster of talent to work with. And not only that, if these two girls really don't like each other, then someone like Sasha should be embracing the possibility of being able to go to a different brand so they don't have to constantly be paired off with this person that they hate. So I thought that was a very weird proposal for him to make because I just kept thinking to myself, that's exactly what they probably want, right? In storyline, why wouldn't these women want to leave Raw and get away from each other and go work for Paige on SmackDown? They wouldn't have any therapy sessions anymore that they'd have to deal with. You know, no more Dr. Happy, not Dr. Happy, Dr. What the fuck is that guy's name? Oh my God. It's popped out of my head. Dr. Happy, Dr. Oh my God, Dr. The doctor. They won't have to deal with the Dr. Shelby. Dr. Shelby, there you go. Dr. Happy. Oh my God. That sounds awful. Yeah, if you ever have to go see a doctor named Dr. Happy, I'd be a little concerned. I would not let that doctor put me under for any kind of procedure. I would want to be awake and alert at all times. In any event, they took on Dana Brooke and Alicia Fox. Another reason why these two women should want to run, not walk, to SmackDown. Because on Raw, they're wrestling Dana Brooke and Alicia Fox. I don't even know that they ever announced the finish to this match. The bell rang. I assume it was a DQ. Bayley was getting the crap beaten out of her outside. Sasha could take no more. She came over. She starts beating up Dana and Alicia. Referee called the match off. So we go backstage, and Sasha is collecting her stuff. She's packing her bag. She's about to leave. And Bayley stops her. And Sasha said, you know, she did what she did because I don't want anybody else to beat you up. Only I can do that. But when I see somebody else beating you up and ganging up on you, that I can't tolerate. And Bayley said, that means you care. And Sasha said, of course I care. I love that you're a good person. I love that you love everybody, that all the little girls look up to you. I don't know why you don't get it. I love you, she said. I always have, and I always will. There, I said it. And she walked off. If Sasha doesn't turn on Bayley now, I'm going to be very disappointed. All she has to do now is lower the boom and she'll get massive heat. I watched this and I thought to myself, Sasha Banks getting all mushy? There's no way that she's forgotten about how Bayley kicked her ass. She's lulling her into a false sense of security and telling her, I love you, and when the time is right, boom, the boss is back, and that leads to their match at SummerSlam. Is that too much to ask? Is that too much to ask? Because that's what I'd like to see happen here. Ronda Rousey is going to SummerSlam to face Alexa Bliss for the Raw Women's title, provided that she does not get herself into any more trouble. Her suspension was not yet up when this show aired, but she came out of the crowd and went after Alexa and Mickey, and so Angle tacked another week onto her suspension. And Bobby Lashley, predictably, beat Elias and Seth Rollins for the right to face Roman Reigns tomorrow night on Raw, with the winner challenging Brock Lesnar for the title at SummerSlam. Brock will be back on the July 30th show, so not this Monday, but next Monday. They had a chance. They had a chance to call an audible and go with Seth Rollins, and they did not do it. And really, once Braun Strowman won that Money in the Bank briefcase, that pretty much, I think, killed the idea dead anyway, kind of looking back on things. But it still would have made for a more interesting match, I think, tomorrow night, and at SummerSlam, and they chose to go in a different direction. SmackDown Live, Twitter poll was, I think, almost the inverse of the Raw poll this week. 2,200 votes, 80% thumbs up, only 20% thumbs down. And there were some very upset people who, you know, talking crap about the poll. These are just people rebelling against Raw. How could you like this show? Look, I've shit on SmackDown almost as equally as I have on Raw, I feel like, in the last couple of months. But, you know, I call a spade a spade. I thought this was a good show overall. Certainly an improvement over Raw. Maybe the bar is set so low these days that it's impacting and impairing my judgment. But I thought this was a good show. I was surprised by all the hate that it got from people. But it was largely enjoyable. It had a hot finish, too. You know, it had a very unique ending. Involving Randy Orton, no less. Blandy Orton took the night off. We finally got Randy Orton back. AJ Styles opened the show against Andrade Cien Almas. I mean, how could I hate on a show that opens with a match like that? We didn't get to see what these two are capable of. Hopefully they're saving it for a pay-per-view one day. What we had here, though, was good. Good showing, I thought, from Cien Almas, and AJ got the win in the end with the calf crusher. So I enjoyed this, and hopefully it's a sign of things to come with Almas, because Almas is very, very good, and he can mix it up with pretty much anybody on this show. And we're only getting to see sort of bits and pieces, I think, of what he's really capable of, which is one of the reasons why I really hope they have something lined up for him, something meaningful lined up for him at SummerSlam. Because whether it's an opening match on the card, he could go out there in Brooklyn at SummerSlam if they give him 15 minutes plus with somebody good, like a Daniel Bryan or somebody. I mean, it's not going to be Bryan. I'm just saying somebody like that. I'm trying to think who it would be. I guess Jeff Hardy would be occupied. I'm not sure offhand. I'd have to think about who would be the best person to sort of match him up with. It's possible he could be the odd man out. There may not be that one person for him to really work with to have a standout match. But he should have some sort of match at SummerSlam. Because he's going to be a big player on this brand going forward. As well he should be. Aiden English was apologizing backstage to Lana, slipping in and out of her Russian accent. Her accent seemingly has a mind of its own. It's like it comes, it goes, it comes, it goes. Soon her accent and Kofi Kingston's Jamaican accent are going to go run off together. They're going to start a family with John Cena's Boston accent. So this storyline is continuing as far as there being dissension in the ranks, and Aiden is very upset about what he did that effectively led to Rusev losing in his match with AJ Styles at Extreme Rules. Now he's trying to kind of make up for it, and Lana said she'll take it into consideration. Becky Lynch racked up another win, this time over Mandy Rose, and then finally she took the mic and she cut a promo challenging Carmella for her women's championship. Paige made a match for SmackDown this Tuesday, non-title between Carmella and Becky. If Becky wins, she will challenge for the SmackDown Women's title at SummerSlam. And this is a story, I first mentioned it. Other people have been mentioning it in recent weeks. I mentioned it weeks and weeks ago. I said, low-key, this is one of the best stories they're telling on SmackDown right now, which is Becky Lynch keeps winning. And at the time, nobody was really drawing any attention to it, but I was like, wait a minute, she's had, you know, she's beaten this person and that person, and yeah, she didn't win at Money in the Bank, but, you know, she's been winning a lot of her matches, which is the opposite of what she had been doing. She had been on this losing streak, she wasn't doing anything meaningful on the show, and yet, she retains her popularity. She is still one of the most popular women on that roster. And so now she's been winning and winning and winning, and wouldn't you know, when you start winning matches, it puts you in contention for the championship. Unless she goes out there on Tuesday and loses. That would be dumb. But the best story they could tell right now, it doesn't even really involve Asuka. And Asuka got screwed. Asuka got screwed big time in those matches with Carmella. They did Asuka no favors. It did not take them very long to, I don't want to say ruin Asuka, but certainly Asuka does not have that same... And not just because she lost to Charlotte at WrestleMania. I'm not saying that the only way to have kept Asuka feeling really special was to just keep her undefeated. You know, you can only remain unbeaten for so long and, you know, without not making things seem interesting. I get that. But they've done Asuka no favors since coming to the main roster. I'm not shocked. I don't know anybody who should be shocked by that. But I think Becky is the one. Becky is the right person for the role. I think the people will get behind her. I think it's a great story to tell. And I think you pull the trigger and you do the title change at SummerSlam and you give Becky a big win in Brooklyn. We had a dominant win for Samoa Joe over Ty Dillinger, including throwing him face first into the ring post from an atomic drop position. He just picked him up and just wham, right into the post. Paige will announce an opponent for AJ Styles at SummerSlam this Tuesday. And for my money, Samoa Joe would seem to be the front runner for that spot. Just by process of elimination, when you look at all the top names on SmackDown, and also just the fact that Joe, you know, they don't have anything for him. He's beaten Ty Dillinger in squash matches on TV. I think they're just biding their time until they make the announcement, and it will be AJ and Joe for the championship at SummerSlam. Miz held a mock funeral for Team Hell No with Paul Bearers and with Paul Bearers and everything, and Daniel Bryan eventually came out. He attacked the Miz. He attacked one of the Paul Bearers. So it's clear that they're not waiting any longer. They are doing Miz and Bryan, most likely, at SummerSlam. I still think it could be a big WrestleMania match, whether they do it at SummerSlam or not. But this was inevitable, because there's still a very long time to go before WrestleMania. Which, had Vince McMahon realized this in 1993, maybe Lex Luger would not have flopped as hard as he did, because there's a lot of time between SummerSlam and WrestleMania. And so by the time WrestleMania 10 rolled around, Luger wasn't the golden child anymore, and they put the title on Bret Hart. But in any event, unless Bryan is challenging for the WWE title after this, or even the US title now that Nakamura has it, there's only so many people that you could really program him with, which is the other issue. And so him and Miz matching up at SummerSlam, even though it feels maybe like it's a little too quick, it probably makes the most sense. And like I said before, it does not mean that it's a one and done. You know, you could always revisit this feud. Maybe eventually when they come back to it, you know, Miz is the champion or something and they could fight for the title. You don't have to do that right out of the gate in the very first match. I would love to see Bryan and Almas do something together. It doesn't look like that's the direction they're going to go in. We still don't know for sure if he's re-signing with the company or not. I'm sure he is. Apparently he's leaning in that direction. I've thought for a while now that he's going to resign because they're going to throw everything at him that he wants. And he's got his wife and her reality show to consider as well. He can't just think of himself. And so, yeah, like 80-20, I'm almost positive that Daniel Bryan will resign. Will it be for a year? Will it be for 3 years? That we don't know. But apparently he has not yet signed. The reports came out saying he did. Meltzer came out and said he has not. It could be a case also, I think we have to consider, of them just wanting to do this match now and get this match out of the way in the event that he does leave and they're not able to do it. And then they can give Miz a big win. Bryan can put him over on his way out. I wonder if that may be part of the consideration here in doing this match so quickly. Jeff Hardy got his rematch for the United States title against Shinsuke Nakamura. A real match this time, too, not a 5-second angle. Hardy countered a Kinshasa attempt into a twist of fate. He went up top for the Swanton Bomb. He destroyed Nakamura with it. You know, Jeff's talked about this in interviews. His body is just so thrashed. He just doesn't care anymore, basically. He goes out there and just wrecks his opponent on those landings. It does make the move look a lot more devastating, I will say that. The Swanton used to look... It's kind of like when John Morrison, right, Johnny Mundo, hits Starship Pain... I think the End of the World move. It looks cool when he kind of bounces and does the little twisting deal in the air, but he barely grazes his opponent, like, and he's beating people with this. And to me, it's just completely ridiculous because he's barely even connecting with them on the way down. That kind of used to be Jeff, right? Jeff's head used to hit the person's arm when he would come down. Now it's his entire fucking body. He's just saying, I don't give a shit anymore. I'm 40 years old. I don't give a fuck. And he is just swantoning the crap out of people. But it makes the move actually look devastating for a change. So he had the match won with the Swanton, but when all of a sudden Randy Orton appears, he yanks Jeff out of the ring and starts beating on him. So that's good enough for a DQ. And Orton then proceeds to beat up Jeff Hardy for an uncomfortably long stretch of time. And he's asking Jeff, you want to know why I attacked you? But then he never actually told him, so we're left to wonder why. Why is Randy Orton out to kill Jeff Hardy? Unless they swerve us on the explanation, it would seem to make sense, because the last time we saw Randy Orton back in May, he lost to Jeff Hardy at Backlash. They had a feud, they had a program. Remember when Hardy came out that one night on SmackDown, thinking he sort of walked right by Orton? I think Shelton Benjamin maybe was in the ring. He had issued a challenge. So I think it just all goes back to that, unless they introduce another wrinkle into things. Sometimes I think they overthink these things, and just if you stick with the simple story, those are the ones that work the most. So Orton reaches down, and we see that Jeff Hardy has an unusually large hole in his earlobe, where an earring would go. I don't know. To me, it seemed abnormally large. Maybe that's normal. Orton sees this, and the sick SOB that he is, he takes his finger, and he sticks his finger in the hole. He sticks his finger into Jeff Hardy's hole, and he is yanking on it, and he is just yanking on the skin, and Hardy is screaming in agony. It looked absolutely disgusting. They even got a great shot of some random girl in the crowd clutching her own ear and wincing. Reminded me of those old shots they used to get at, like, Superstars and wrestling challenge tapings of fan reactions. Like when the King Cobra bit Randy Savage on the arm. I still remember them showing the reaction on this little ugly kid's face. So Orton then gives Hardy a draping DDT off the announce table onto the floor. This is the most interesting version of Randy Orton, the one who just comes out and, you know, sadistically just beats the crap out of people. The sadistic Randy Orton, this is 2009 Randy Orton, the one who punted Vince McMahon in the head, the one that had that I Quit match with John Cena, which I still think is one of their best matches, at that Breaking Point pay-per-view where he handcuffed Cena to the ring post and he pummeled him with a kendo stick. If we assume Orton beats Hardy at SummerSlam, if that's the match, and let's say Orton wins, and also let's say AJ manages to retain the championship over whoever he defends it against at SummerSlam, and I'm not convinced he will, but let's say he does, Orton and Styles is a program that we have not yet seen. I know they've had a couple of matches on TV. I think Randy Orton even beat him once on SmackDown a couple of years ago, or maybe last year, to go to the main event of WrestleMania. Oh, I say main event. I think that was the match he had with Bray Wyatt, which was hardly the main event. So they've had a couple of matches on TV before, but never a full-blown program. And we still have not had, you know, heel Orton against AJ Styles for the championship, and perhaps we're setting up for that post-SummerSlam. I think those two could do some great work together. And I have not been the biggest Randy Orton fan for a while now. Frankly, I'm still not. But of all the iterations and versions of Randy Orton that we've been subjected to, this has been, you know, in the past, the most interesting. You know, he's still Randy Orton, okay, but if we're going to get Randy Orton in a prime position on the show, I would rather see this version of him than whatever the hell it was we had before. And frankly, I'm sure he's very happy as well. He's made no bones about the fact that he hates being a babyface. He detests it. And why would he? Why would he like being a babyface? Randy Orton strikes me as being a heel in real life. And so this is just him being himself and sticking his finger in people's holes. Paige has also on social media announced a tag team tournament starting this week on SmackDown. It will take place over the next 3 weeks to determine who will face the Bludgeon Brothers at SummerSlam for the titles. She did not mention who any of the teams would be. Of the options that I could think of, honestly, none of them are really all that appealing. New Day would just feel tired, like a retread. So would the Usos. Sheamus and Cesaro, I don't know where the hell they've been. They've been off TV, it feels like, for months and months. And heel against heel, unless they come back as babyfaces. Heel against heel does not sound like a good idea to me. Sanity is another example. They're heels. I don't, frankly, want to see them either in that spot. What does that leave you with? I mean, Gallows and Anderson? We've been there, done that. Someone tweeted me the other day asking if he's alone in feeling bored by the Bludgeon Brothers. No, you're not alone. But show me a team on this brand right now that would be that much more appealing. I mean, you could always put the belts back on the Usos or the New Day, and I guess, you know, they're more interesting than the Bludgeon Brothers, but that just feels like you're just going back to the same well one too many times. You know, those aren't the only two teams that you have on the show, but you look at the rest of the tag team roster, it's very thin. Now, maybe they can put Rusev and Aiden English together because English is trying to earn back Rusev's trust, right? As we saw on TV this week. Maybe that's the way to go. And that way they could do a title change and they can give Rusev a big title win in Brooklyn. That may be the only Bludgeon Brothers match I could think of where you might actually have a chance to get the fans really into it.
Hey, Sell the Monster Sounds Off podcast listeners. I'm Wade Keller from Pro Wrestling Torch. Maybe you've heard me on the Steve Austin Show on a regular basis, recapping pay-per-views. Well, now you can hear me four times per week. I do a post-Raw and post-SmackDown show called the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show with co-hosts, including, on a regular basis, Jason Solomon himself. Plus, live callers, our mailbag segment, and an on-site correspondent. And then later in the week, my Podcast One shows feature the Thursday flagship and Interview Friday. Check them out. Search Wade Keller in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or anywhere that you listen to Pro Wrestling Podcast.
There was a major spoiler coming out of this week's NXT tapings for the show that airs this Wednesday. If you do not want to hear about it, please skip ahead. It is not yet aired on TV, which makes it a spoiler, so skip ahead 5 minutes or so if you don't want to hear about it. In the NXT Championship match between Aleister Black and Tommaso Ciampa that airs this week, the referee was bumped. Johnny Gargano came out. He attacked both men. But in the end, Ciampa was able to score the pin on Aleister Black and become the new NXT champion. And so all roads now lead to TakeOver Brooklyn. There will be a triple threat match with Ciampa defending against both Gargano and Aleister Black. My idea, if you guys remember, was to put the title on Ciampa in Brooklyn and have him inadvertently cost, or have Gargano inadvertently cost Aleister the title and sort of watch or be forced to watch as Ciampa walked out as champion. Sounds like they're doing the similar thing, only they're doing it on TV this week, so we'll see how it plays out. But this is great news. This is great news. Ciampa is among the best heels, if not the best heel, right now in the business, certainly in this company, in the entire company. And I wonder if it means we're in for an Aleister Black call-up very soon. A few weeks ago when I pitched Ciampa winning the title in Brooklyn, I also mentioned the possibility that Aleister Black could then debut on Monday Night Raw the very next night. I still think there's a very good chance of that happening. Keith Lee was among the new recruits at the Performance Center this past week, and he made his debut on those TV tapings as well. I'm not sure if it's actually airing on TV or if it was a dark match. My guess is it will air on TV either this week or next. And he came out and got a great reaction. And so Keith Lee, apparently they're wasting no time in getting him onto the brand. And I think he'll do well. I mean, I've seen some of his matches, you know, on the indies and everything. And he's a very talented guy. But I think of other talented guys who also have come through NXT and ended up on the main roster. I keep thinking of Apollo Crews, you know, and how when I saw him, he was also, I mean, Keith Lee is a bigger guy, but Apollo's a guy you look at, he's, you know, put together, he's in great shape, and he's able to do things, you know, physically that you would think a guy like him maybe wouldn't be able to do. And the thing is, he's got the personality, or at least at the beginning, he had the personality on TV of a fucking doorknob. And so they didn't do anything with him. Probably they just thought, well, you know, whatever, he's an athletic guy, but he's got no charisma. They tried to bring it out of him. I'm still not sure exactly who's to blame for that. I think WWE ultimately is to blame, because if you have a guy who has the gifts that he has, you know, you should try to find a way. You've got this army of writers and people that they're working with. You should try even harder than they have to find a way to get this guy over. And he's a glorified job guy. You know, Apollo Crews had a lot of buzz around him when he came in, and he turned into a glorified job guy on the main roster. I'm not saying he should be Universal Champion, but, you know, surely they should be doing more with him than they are. I don't want to see somebody like Keith Lee fall into the same sort of situation or the same circumstance that Apollo Crews did. Question is, you know, how do they view him? You know, and we'll see. I mean, we'll see how he does in NXT. Personality-wise, it's not just about in-ring. It's about personality. It's about verbal skills, things that Crews was lacking a lot of. You know, it's not only WWE's fault. I just think they could have worked harder, though, to do something with somebody who had the kind of talent that he had. And hopefully Keith Lee does not fall victim to the same thing. As far as the show that aired this past week, NXT, Lacey Evans got a win over Dakota Kai with the woman's right, as in the woman's right hand. I hate her whole gimmick. I just cannot help but look at this woman and not think about Liberty Bell from GLOW. But she's got talent. I can see why they see something in her. The whole prim and proper lady thing to me is just poison. I just don't like it. We got a great War Raiders video package. This was in the same vein as those TM61 segments they aired a few months ago, explaining who these guys are. They talked about their success in Japan. They even showed a photo of them posing with Hiroshi Tanahashi. A lot of progress footage, a lot of ICW footage, obviously nothing from Ring of Honor. They also covered Ray Rowe's motorcycle accident that he had that almost killed him 4 years ago. He was in a very serious motorcycle accident. I can remember Hansen got a singles push out of it for a while. I was at one of those Terminal 5 shows when they were running Terminal 5 and taking a break from Hammerstein. That he was in a big four-way, I remember. He was, you know, he did well, actually. I think Hansen did well for himself as a single until Rowe came back. But anyway, so yeah, they talked about Rowe's motorcycle accident. Rowe, of course, being Sarah Logan's better half. And he was so lucky to be alive after that wreck that his own doctors really could not explain to him how he survived. And surely they didn't think he'd be wrestling again. And now not only is he wrestling again, he's riding motorcycles again. And maybe he should be a little careful this time. But in any event, more of this. More of this, because the War Raiders, look, they're a great big man team. They can go in there and do things, again, that you would not expect guys that big, you know, to do. When you see someone like Hansen doing top rope leg drops, that's impressive. But they've not done anything to really get me interested in these guys since they debuted. TM61, same problem. But vignettes like this will help at least explain to people who these guys are, why they're here, why we should care. And I thought this was very well done. Kairi Sane, in the main event, beat Candice LeRae and Nikki Cross to earn a shot at Shayna Baszler in the NXT Women's title at TakeOver Brooklyn. This was really good. A lot of action throughout this match. I really liked this match. Shayna sat in on commentary. That wasn't so good. But there was a Tower of Doom spot where Nikki superplexed Kairi while Candice powerbombed Nikki from the ropes. Candice then hits a simultaneous DDT flatliner combo to Nikki and to Kairi. Candice hit the Quebrada on Kairi. I love the height she gets on that. Nikki broke up the pin, hit a draping neck breaker on Candice on the floor, or down to the floor, while Candice was sort of hanging over the apron. Nikki beat up Kairi for a while. Candice recovered. She hit another lion salt, this time on Nikki. Had the match seemingly won, but then Kairi Sane like a meteor from the sky just sort of fell from the sky. It was great because we couldn't see her, and all of a sudden she comes into camera frame and she just lands on Candace with this insane elbow drop. That's what they call it, the insane elbow. And she covered Candace for the win. So Kairi Sane will challenge Shayna Baszler to TakeOver in a rematch from the finals of last year's Mae Young Classic. We have the second one about to kick off, I think August 7th and 8th, or August 8th and 9th, I think is when they're taping. That was the finals of last year's tournament. Kairi won last year. I don't think she wins this time. I think Shayna hangs on, but it'll be fun to watch. Shayna's improving. I enjoyed her match with Toni Storm on that Royal Albert Hall show. And Kairi, we already know, Kairi is great. Lucha Underground, Episode 6. We had the debut of Desmond Xavier, against Paul London of the White Rabbit Tribe, fresh off his murder of Masquerita Sagrada last week. This was for the last of the 7 ancient Aztec medallions. Xavier, I thought he looked impressive. And actually, he won, which we don't, I mean, how often do we see that on this show, right? Someone in their debut winning, right? Matanza did when he first debuted, but doesn't happen very often. So he gets the final medallion. I would imagine that Killer Cross will not be very pleased when he learns that Paul London was unsuccessful. But we didn't see Killer Cross on this show at all. So this all brings out Antonio Cueto. He comes out, he invites all of the Gift of the Gods winners to come out so they can place their medallion in the title belt. And let me just say, I still think that that's the coolest thing. And I'm a belt mark anyway, but I just think it's unique. You know, when they come out, they got the magnets in them and they put them in the belt, and the belt itself looks cool. I like that. So we had Desmond back out there, Dragon Azteca Jr., King Cuerno, Eva Lee, Son of Havoc, the Mac, and Mil Muertes, obviously with Katrina. And so Antonio decides to have a little fun. He's like, well, since I have you all out here, we're going to have an impromptu battle royale, with the winner getting to choose one of the other Gift of the Gods winners to expel from the Gift of the Gods match. So the winner gets to basically bounce whoever they want from the final match. And so right out of the gate, Mil Muertes dumps out a bunch of dudes. He eliminates King Cuerno. He eliminates Eva Lee and Desmond. Then finally, he gets dumped himself. Match came down to Son of Havoc and the Mac, 2/3 of the trio's champs. What are they going to do? There's already been some dissension in the ranks, right, with Killshot. Havoc decides to eliminate himself. He does a dive out over the top rope, wipes out everybody on the floor. He intentionally eliminated himself because he did not want to fight his friend. I would have chosen to boot him from that Gift of the Gods match if I was the Mac. This is wrestling. It's every man for himself. The man is weak. There are no friends. Instead, Mac was just honest. He said, Mil Muertes, and I quote him here, Mil Muertes scares the shit out of me. So he chose to boot Mil Muertes. Well, he's not wrong. Mil Muertes is a very scary individual. Katrina did not look pleased, and she walked out. I'm watching this, I'm like, oh man, you can see this breakup coming from a mile away. This could be my shot. Johnny Mundo against Vibora of the Reptile Tribe. This turned out to be what I think really was a breakout performance for Vibora. Now, for those who don't know, I've mentioned this before. We have some new listeners. Vibora is portrayed by Austin Mattelson. And if that name sounds familiar, he was Judas Devlin in WWE Developmental before he got cut a number of years ago. I think probably 5 years ago now at this point. And it was a couple of years later that all that shit went down with Bill DeMott, the whole controversy involving him, and he got in hot water. Ultimately, he got, you know, booted. But at that point, Mattelson came forward to talk about how DeMott used to bully and mistreat a lot of the trainees, you know, at the Performance Center. And he even released a copy of a memo, a long memo, that he had written and sent to WWE staff in, it would have been 2013, I guess, when he got cut, explaining all of the things in detail that DeMott did. So he ended up here in Lucha Underground as a giant reptile. The Luchasaurus is what fans call him. Well, this giant reptile had his coming out party here in this match. I would even go so far as to say that this felt to me like a double turn. Whether it was intended that way or not, maybe it's just for one night it felt that way, but that's what it, when this thing was over, it felt that way to me. When this match started, Johnny Mundo was the clear favorite, even though he's still a heel. He hasn't done anything to become a babyface, but the fans seem to be more into him lately. By the end of this match, the crowd was cheering for and showing respect to Vibora. And we had a ton of interference from members of the Reptile Tribe, members of the Worldwide Underground. Taya fought with Cobra Moon. PJ Black came out. He hit Vibora with a chair. Mundo hit the end of the world. Vibora kicked out. Mundo then super kicked the referee. PJ and Taya wrapped a chair around Vibora's head. Drago and Daga came out to his rescue. And Ricky Mundo came out to try to help Johnny, pulled him out to the floor. Vibora, who is 7 feet tall, and you can't teach that, he hit a moonsault from the middle rope on the outside. That's a 7-foot man doing that. 3 super kicks from Johnny Mundo, but he got goozled as he went for a springboard off the ropes, and he got chokeslammed and pinned. A very good match. And will it lead to bigger things for the Vibora character? Is he going to be more prominently featured on the show? I don't know. Probably not. Again, remember, these things are taped so far in advance, and you know you never really know what the reaction, at least from the TV viewing audience, is going to be. So I think for one night at least, he got the spotlight. I thought he took advantage of it. Now, he was in there with Mundo, who's very good. I don't know that Vibora would have had that same kind of match with somebody else, necessarily. You know, Big Bad Steve or someone like that. But this was a very good showing for him. And I look at him, I'm like looking at him and the body type and the tats and everything, and he's like a more athletic version of Baron Corbin with hair. And a fucking reptile mask on his head. If Corbin wore a mask, I might actually find him more interesting too. We cut to a skit with Jack Evans and Ricky Mundo in what I guess is supposed to be Jack's apartment. He is still stewing about his loss to Exolicious a few weeks ago. He was actually peeping. Exolicious, I guess, has an apartment in the building across the way, and he was peeping on him through the window. And Ricky tells Jack, they go, you know, we're getting our asses kicked here by this reptile tribe. We really could have used your help. And Evan said, look, I don't do snakes. And Johnny gave me permission to sit this one out. And he told Ricky and his dirty ass doll to mind their own business. And then he walked out. He walked out of his own apartment. So then we have Ricky is the only one left there. He's got this creepy ass doll. And his doll starts talking to him again. Rosa is the doll's name. And the doll says, I don't like him. Maybe you should do to him what you did to Angelico. Basically teasing that Ricky must have killed Angelico. Another murder. Now granted, this one's only implied. This is an implied murder, but still, we can add Angelico to the long list this season of murders and deaths here on this show. Ricky said that, I can't, you know, Johnny would be mad. And the doll says, who's in charge of your life, Johnny or you? That's my doll voice. My creepy doll voice, by the way. That doll really, I gotta say, that doll creeps me the fuck out, man. It's good. That's the whole point. They managed to come up with a creepy looking doll and the voice and everything, but it does. It creeps me the fuck out. Main event was Cage challenging Pentagon Dark for the Lucha Underground title. One of Steve Austin's favorite wrestlers in the world to watch right now, Pentagon Dark. He said so on his most recent podcast, the one he did with Joey Janela. Solid outing here for Cage. Match was fine. Another big win, though, for the champion. 2 Canadian Destroyers and a package pile driver by Pentagon was enough for the win. Pentagon did try to break Cage's arm after the match, but Cage overpowered him and turned it into an F5 onto the title belt, and Cage held the belt up, so I guess that even though he lost clean here, this is not over. Probably setting up for some kind of a gimmick match between these two. I'm giving sad tweet honors this week to Wiz Khalifa. The tweet itself did not come from him. It was a tweet about him and something he said from @thatgrapejuice, which calls itself your number one source for urban pop culture. And who's more in tune with urban pop culture than yours truly? In this tweet was the headline, Wiz Khalifa says straight men should not eat bananas. And the link brought me to this story claiming that Wiz Khalifa has urged heterosexual men to think twice before eating bananas, as doing so may cause those around them to look at them suspiciously. Wiz was on the Breakfast Club radio show with DJ Envy, Angela Yee, and Charlemagne the God. When he made these comments, he said, "If you bite a banana, you sus." He then said, I guess that's suspect, I guess. He said that you need to break the banana in half. Pause. That's what he said. As if that isn't stupid enough. What is this pause stuff? I listened to that part of the interview. He kept saying pause the whole time. They were talking about fruit. They were having this discussion about bananas and apples and pears and fruit. And the whole time they asked him, like, what's your favorite fruit? He goes, pause. Slices of apple. Pause. I actually had to look this shit up. It was so annoying. I said, I gotta know what this means. So I go online, I look it up, and from what I can gather, people say pause after something that may be taken as homosexual. Imagine how annoying that would get in wrestling promos. I'm gonna beat your ass. Pause. Your ass belongs to me. Pause. Randy Orton stuck his finger in Jeff Hardy's hole. Pause. Actually, that one makes sense. Shit, I mean, that would get more annoying than the what chant. So, yeah. If you ever come across Wiz Khalifa on the street, buy a banana and eat it in front of him. You'll make him very uncomfortable. Let's get to your mailbag questions. You can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. The city and state, not planet. Ren from Pittsburgh. As a female fan, in response to your question, if 50-second counseling segments on TV with Bailey and Sasha sharing their feelings and mocking each other actually appeals to us, the answer is no. I was so livid when I saw that they were turning their feud into a frenemies angle. They did it with Paige and AJ Lee, and I thought it was dumb then. And when I saw Sasha profess her love to Bailey last week, I shook my head in disappointment. I feel bad for Bailey and Sasha because they've spent the last year doing what they can to keep people interested in their feud. And besides Bailey beating down Sasha a few weeks ago, their feud has gotten little to no TV time and has done virtually nothing to progress the storyline. Between Rousey and Bliss at SummerSlam, along with Carmella and most likely Becky Lynch, how do you think the Bailey and Sasha build stacks up against the other female storylines? Out of the three, which match do you think people will be the most invested in? And after seeing the current build, do you think waiting until SummerSlam was a good decision? Well, we'll find out at SummerSlam, I guess, right? If it was a good idea, I can't really judge it until then. I think with the right build, yeah, it would have been a good idea to hold off, to get to Brooklyn, to play off the whole 3 years since their big NXT match thing. You know, either the payoff or, in this case, likely the first match between them should be at SummerSlam. Not really the first. I mean, the first one in a while. It's not like they haven't had matches before on TV. I do think the people are going to be most invested, though, in seeing Ronda Rousey kill Alexa Bliss and win her first women's title. Of the three, I think they're gonna be behind Becky, and I think in Brooklyn, I think even Sasha and Bayley will get, you know, a good reaction. But I think of the three, that's what people are going to be the most into, because Rousey, she's still a star, right? She's a big star, so people are into that. But they also seem to be buying into the storyline because Alexa, people are sick and tired of Alexa Bliss having that championship. She's had a stranglehold on it for so long. And they've done a very good job of Alexa just being annoying and, you know, Rousey coming out and trying to kill her and being suspended and stopped. And once they let her loose at SummerSlam, once they let her out of her cage, she'll be like an uncaged animal at SummerSlam. And I don't expect that match to be overly long. I think people are going to be most into that of all the women's stuff on that show. Aaron in Virginia Beach, I believe WWE is deliberately trying to put the Universal title on Bobby Lashley just to have Hulk Hogan crown him as the first black champion so that Hogan can fix his reputation. What do you think? Well, Ryan Satin was the first person I saw pitching that idea as something that popped into his head. And if that idea were a person, I would say kill it with fire. That will not happen. It will not happen. It should not happen. And let us never speak of it again. Lashley, also, this whole notion Lashley is being the first black champion. Lashley would not be the first black anything in WWE. That distinction belongs to Bobo Brazil. Bobo Brazil won the NWA title, although I'm not sure why the NWA never really officially recognized it. But I knew, you know, Bobo Brazil's name, and I looked it up. It was the NWA. It was the NWA title that he won. This would have been back in the 60s. So you could argue, well, it's not officially recognized by the NWA. Okay, fine. Then it would be Ron Simmons. Ron Simmons beat Vader and became the world champion in WCW in 1992. Either way, and then there's The Rock and everything. Either way, Lashley is not the first. He will not be the first anything if he wins this champion. I guess I will say this. If Bobby Lashley wins the Universal title, he will be the first African-American star to win the Universal title. There you go. That's about the only first that he'll have. And besides, Lashley was already the ECW champion. So him winning the fruit roll-up belt now really would not be that big of a deal. We had Jack here from London, England. I was watching WrestleMania 9. And although it was a terrible show, I thought Shawn Michaels against Tatanka was the best match on the card. This got me thinking. From WrestleMania 9 onward, Shawn Michaels had probably the best match on every WrestleMania show that he was on. Do you agree? I thought that was a very interesting question from Jack. And I thought about this, and I'm going to say no. But it is very, very close. You would not be wrong if you said yes, but it's a subjective thing. But let's run through this, okay? So he had the match with Tatanka at WrestleMania 9. I actually remember the Steiner Brothers and the Head Shrinkers match not being all that bad. I remember Scott Steiner almost being killed. If you remember the spot, I'm sure many of you probably do remember the spot I'm talking about where he kind of fell over the top rope and took a header out to the floor. But yeah, Shawn and Tatanka as a match probably was the best match on that card. WrestleMania 10, you could argue that Shawn and Razor outdid Bret and Owen, and that it's certainly historically, it's a more significant match. Was it the better match? I like Bret and Owen more, but you would not be wrong if you went with the latter match. So I'll give you the latter match. Because that's not the only place where I think you're wrong, so, but I'll give that one to you. WrestleMania 11 was just a shit show, so by default, yeah, Shawn and Diesel had the best match on the card. Although LT impressed me. He was completely gassed by the end of that match with Bam Bam, but I can't say that he had a better match than Shawn and Diesel did. WrestleMania 12, yes, we had the Iron Man match, right? WrestleMania 13, Shawn did commentary because of his phony knee injury. WrestleMania 14... did not have very many great matches. I didn't even think, frankly, his match with Steve Austin was all that great, but his back was in shambles, so it's understandable. Given that his back was in the condition that it was in, it's amazing he even had the match at all, let alone put together at least a decent match. But yeah, probably still the best match on that show, right? So then he goes away. He's gone for a number of years. WrestleMania 19 is his WrestleMania return against Chris Jericho. I would agree. I would say that him and Jericho had the best match on that show. WrestleMania 20, Triple Threat against Benoit and Triple H. Definitely. Best match on the show. WrestleMania 21 against Kurt Angle. Yes, I would agree. WrestleMania 22 against Vince McMahon. This is where I disagree. I liked the Trish Stratus-Mickey James match. I thought that was a good match. And I thought Shawn Michaels got a really good match out of Vince McMahon. That's not an easy thing to do. Now, Hulk Hogan did as well at WrestleMania 19. But by and large, Vince McMahon's actual matches, they're not exactly great matches. That's not really what Vince is known for. But Shawn got a really good match out of him. They had the, you know, having the blunder and the hardcore rules helped. And being able to use ladders and tables and trash cans. And there was an absolutely sickening chair shot that he gave to Vince right in the head in that match. But they had a good match. But the reason I disagree is that I think Edge and Mick Foley had the best match at WrestleMania 22. And what that match did for Edge's career was worth far more than any storyline feud between Shawn Michaels and Vince McMahon. So that's, if not WrestleMania 10, the show where I would disagree is actually WrestleMania 22. WrestleMania 23 against John Cena, yes, I would agree, best match on the show. WrestleMania 24 against Ric Flair, I mean, just for the story and the emotion of it alone, yes, I know a lot of you might say Undertaker and Edge. I was not as much of a fan of that match as other people were. But I could see people thinking, no, 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 you know, Undertaker and Edge had the best match on the card that night. I'll say this, Charles Robinson certainly had the best run-in. I think we could all agree on that. And WrestleMania 25 and 26 go without saying. Shawn Michaels and Undertaker at WrestleMania 25 is still my favorite WrestleMania match of all time. And the thing about it that's so crazy is most of the matches that I just mentioned that we just ran through from 19 onward, most of those WrestleMania matches came after he came back from the back injury. The second half of his career, the second act. I guess that's what happens when you get 4 years off to rest. You come back refreshed. Jad from London, England. I'm listening to the podcast Bruce and Conrad did about the creation of Monday Night Raw. Bruce says that when trying to describe it to people, they just tried to use any word starting with un that they could think of. Uncut, uncensored, uncooked, unpredictable. In terms of the show these days, what word starting with un would you use to describe Monday Night Raw? Unwatchable. That's the first word that comes to mind. Unwatchable. Unacceptable. Unpleasant. I could go on all day. Joey from Canada, buy or sell. I have a movie theme buy or sell for you this week. Since we just passed the 10-year anniversary of the release of The Dark Knight, I thought this might be appropriate. Buy or sell on these two phenomenal movie villains, Heath Ledger as the Joker in The Dark Knight, or Javier Bardem as Anton Chigurh in No Country for Old Men. Ooh, that's a good one. That's why I plucked this one out. That was good. Javier Bardem was incredible in No Country for Old Men. If you've not seen that movie, please do yourself a favor and go watch it. But I have to buy on Ledger as the Joker. I'll buy on him. I'll sell on Bardem. I can't vote against the performance that Ledger gave in that movie. And you're right. We just passed the 10-year anniversary of The Dark Knight. It's one of my all-time favorite films. And what a shame, right, that we never got to see more of him in that role. Now we may end up with two different versions of the Joker. We're going to end up with two different Joker films, it sounds like, that are either in development or may soon be in development. Neither of which are Heath Ledger, and that sucks. Although I am curious to see what Joaquin Phoenix can do with that character. He may well be the perfect casting for it because, you know, obviously he's a great actor, but he's also a lunatic. And so is the Joker. So he may not have to do much in the way of acting for this role. But they also, so for those who don't know, they just announced a Joker origin film that they've greenlit with Joaquin Phoenix as the Joker. Martin Scorsese is the executive producer. It's supposed to be a darker film with a lower budget. So I'm genuinely excited to see how that turns out. But then I read that Jared Leto's Joker from Suicide Squad may also be getting his own movie. And the two are going to be completely independent of each other. Now, I didn't see Suicide Squad. I just wasn't interested enough to go see it. I did watch the Jared Leto scenes, or some of them anyway, that popped up online, of him as the Joker. And I wasn't impressed. And, you know, it's interesting. You mentioned The Dark Knight, and you mentioned No Country for Old Men. And I love both those characters, but they're evil. Right? They're pure evil. They're bad dudes. And it's not that I side with them, like those characters, I didn't side with them, but I find that I enjoy watching movies or TV shows that are more focused on those types of characters. Like, I love The Sopranos. I'm not sure there is a single likable character. Actually, you know, I take that back. Paulie is very entertaining. But I mean, in terms of them being like good people, genuinely likable human beings, I'm not sure there's a single one on that entire show. They're all a bunch of degenerates who probably, in the end, got exactly what they deserved. Adriana did not. She deserved a better fate. But again, not one truly likable human being on that show, but I love that show. Tony's a piece of shit. Yet I watched it and I rooted for him not to get caught and not to get killed. The Shield with Michael Chiklis. As Vic Mackey, a dirty cop, one of my favorite shows. And I rooted for Mackey, even though he was scum, who deserved to be thrown in jail for the things that he did. Breaking Bad, Walter White, another example. The man was a monster, or he turned into one. Same thing, Ozark, with Jason Bateman. It's a great show on Netflix. Another situation where you have not one character on that show, whether it's him, his wife, the kids, not one character on that show that truly is likable. But I just find shows like that and the characters like that more compelling. I mean, I guess it's no different than a wrestling fan who roots for the heels over the babyfaces, which is pretty much every wrestling fan these days, it feels like. By the way, if you're an Ozark fan, season 2 is about to come out. Season 2 is dropping on Netflix on August 31st. It's very Breaking Bad-esque. You watch the show and you really do come away from it thinking, okay, they were clearly going for a Breaking Bad vibe here, only instead of meth, it's money laundering. Let's end on that note. Keep sending in your questions, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Questions of all kinds are accepted here on the show. Although not politics or religion, but pretty much anything else. Let me just say this. I'm not sure that there's going to be a podcast next week. I'm going to try my best to get a show done a few days early. I'm going to be away next weekend. I have a wedding. I'm a groomsman in a wedding, and so I'm going to be away doing that. And between the rehearsal dinner on Friday and the wedding on Saturday and then coming back late on Sunday, there's no time for a podcast. So there may not be a show. I'm going to try to do something if I can, maybe on Thursday, because I really would like to talk about NXT and maybe some more G1, Raw and SmackDown. Is it that obvious, like, when I talk about G1 or Lucha and that kind of stuff, that I'm more sort of, upbeat? I don't know. I kind of got that sense as I was talking about it this week. I felt like I had a smile on my face as I was talking about those shows. That smile has long been absent from my Raw reviews when I record them. But at least SmackDown, I thought, was decent enough this week. So I'll keep you guys posted. I don't know what's going on yet, but once I know more, I'll probably tweet something and let you guys know what's going on. At Solomonster is my handle on there. You can follow me. Thank you, as always, for the support, for the PayPal donations. I'll have some announcements to make about various things coming up in the coming weeks, so you'll want to stay tuned for that. Episode 557 is up next. I don't know if it'll be this week or the week after, but I'll be back real soon with more Sound Off. Until then, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week, and I will see you right back here very soon for more of the Sound Off. Take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
They have Kane in the back. This is what he said. Tonight, I will delight as I enter the abyss with a fellow monster. But it is I who will climb out alone and with a smile across my face. Oh, oh my God. What do they think this is, Shakespeare? I was driving yesterday, and some asshole double parks his car in the service lane. I should have cut a promo the way the WWE would script one out for me. Why art thou parking like one's smelly orifice? I wish 1,000 deaths upon thee. Then I could do a fucking tope and we could fade to commercial.
Since 2007, The Solomonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster Sound Off.